Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about our spiritual evolution, how we as a planet are collectively moving to new awareness. I mean, it's been the awareness we've always had, but somehow it's catching on to a wider collective consciousness. And what's really been in the news lately is this whole idea of near-death experiences, and tonight's guest has written an incredible book about that called Dying to Be Me, My Journey from Cancer to Near Death and to True Healing. Anita Murjani, welcome, Anita.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's such a pleasure for me to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me to talk to you because you're just the way you're sounding now as so personal and immediate is exactly how your book reads. So simple and direct.
Wow, thank you. I'm always so happy when people read my book. It just, it still blows me away that people are reading my book. I just get such a thrill.
Well, it's been a bestseller. You should get used to it by now. But it's written so well. So, I don't know. I just feel like the words flow off the page. Like I said to you before, I get a lot of books from a lot of authors, and I really don't really read most of them. But so I picked up your book. I said I was going to read a couple of pages, and then I really could not put it down.
Wow. Well, see, that makes me so happy. Thank you.
It's in a way a difficult book. You go through how you suffered and died, and then you had this amazing experience on this other side of death. And to know that you're a real person here on the phone. But do you want to talk, about that state? If you want to talk about the part that suffered, but that state, you talk about it in the book, but how would you describe it in more detail somehow than what you've described before?
Okay, it was an indescribable state. I felt that I was surrounded in pure, unconditional love, but it was much more than that. It was more than just unconditional love. It's nothing like the love that we feel here when we express love to each other. It was like I didn't have to do anything to deserve it. I was just loved just because I existed. It didn't even matter what I had done in my life. And this is what is so different from what I had always believed. I had always believed that I had to work hard at being more spiritual and that I had to create, I felt it that we had to create a good experience of the afterlife by working hard all our lives to be spiritual, to be good people, to do things, to go out of our way, to do positive things. But this is what the most interesting thing is. When I was in the other realm, I realized that regardless of what I had done or not done, I was still loved unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize that all I ever had to do was to be myself. And the fact that I had to work, the fact that I believed I had to work hard at being loved meant that I felt that who I am at my core is just not good enough. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. That's not true. Who we are at our core is perfect. We come into this world perfect. And then we spend a lifetime forgetting that and trying to be something we're not. And then we beat ourselves up for failing.
You talk about magnificence. And actually, every time you say that word and I read it, I felt like a joy or a vibration going through my body. Because when you said we're all magnificent and to embrace our magnificence, I started to feel that.
Yeah. In fact, most of us don't even realize how incredible and powerful we are and who we truly are because we lose ourselves along the way, but we are, all of us are so magnificent, and we have this capacity, you know, like if we get down to it, all of us have this capacity to create not just an amazing life for ourselves. It goes beyond that, because when you create an amazing life for yourself, you are actually also touching people around you. And if we're all doing the same thing, what we do is we create an amazing society, you know, an amazing culture, a society, planet. But instead, our focus is always on being not good enough. Because we don't realize our own magnificence, we're very destructive, first towards ourselves, and then that kind of reflects outwards. And so out of our fear of not being good enough, we start being destructive towards others around us, the planet, because we're living in fear of not having enough, not being good enough. And that's why it's so important for us to know how magnificent and amazing we are. And that's what I want everybody to know.
And when you write about it, I feel it. But we come in, we have this, of course, we're coming from that other realm into these bodies, but it seems like, I mean, there's the conditioning, there's the religions, there's the education, upbringing, that. But even before all that happens, are we aware of that magnificence, or are we unconscious to it?
I believe we're actually aware of it. We're born aware of it. I mean, I feel I see it, and this is what it felt in that near-death experience state. It felt as though we're not meant to lose it. It felt as though we come into this world with the intention of keeping it or holding on to it, or with dreams of changing the world, but somehow we fall on the wayside. You know, things get in the way. Our fear gets in the way. Our egos get in the way. All kinds of things get in the way, and we forget. That's what it felt like. And that's what it felt like to me that happens. It felt like that I was sure that I had come in to this world in the first place with my magnificence intact, and I had forgotten it along the way. So I felt that if we all remembered it, it would be different. Our lives would be very, very different.
But if we look at children, I guess they do have a sense of their curiosity and wonder. Yes. And then it's not even so much their ego. It's what comes from outside of them that puts them in these little boxes, puts us, all of us, in these boxes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. When we look at little children, they know that they're special, and they know, I mean, they're full of joy. When you know that you are loved and special, you don't become all selfish and egotistical, which is what the popular perception is. In fact, it's the contrary. You become full of joy, the way you see little children who laugh so easily. That's actually what happens. You become like a child. You laugh easily. You don't take things seriously, and you become a joy to be around. You're a joy to be around other people. You become much more giving. The more you love yourself and the more you realize how powerful you are, you actually become much more generous and giving, because you can afford to be. You're not afraid. You're not afraid of keeping things close to your chest or competing or fighting. You know that you'll get what is yours. And so you become very generous, giving, and joyful and popular. People love people like that, self-actualized people.
Yeah, and those are the charismatic people. But how would you raise a child, you know, teaching them? I mean, you would restructure the whole system, wouldn't you?
I would. That's the thing. We all still get fed into the same system, but I would restructure the whole system. But I actually give credit to a lot of people who homeschool their children, and it is hard work, because the society does not support it. You know, it supports something completely opposite. So it feels like you're swimming upstream. And then on the one hand, I tell people, you're not supposed to be swimming upstream. You're supposed to be going with the flow. But the flow that we have created is kind of a flow that goes against who we really are. Right. And that's the problem. So there's a lot of contradictions and a lot of things to work against. But what I would do regardless even if I had to send my child through the regular system that currently exists, I would still tell my child every single day that they are loved unconditionally. It doesn't mean that I won't reprimand them or I won't tell them if they've done something that's hurtful or point things out to them. But here's one thing that we seem to do pretty much universally. We like to instill fear in children to discipline them. And we think that fear keeps our children well-behaved and keeps them safe and so on. I don't agree with that. I think we need to instill love, self-love, and self-respect into our children. The more a person loves themselves, the more likely they are to keep themselves safe. What keeps you safe is love, not fear.
That's a really good point. Thank you. Thank you. Just that.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry. Did you have something?
Because you're welcome.
No, just that understanding would change everything about how we raise our children.
Yeah.
And
that's what I believe. So simple, and I don't understand why our entire system is built on fear.
But how would you teach love to children, really?
I would tell children that it's okay to be different. You're not supposed to all be the same. And, you know, like I was bullied as a child because I was different. I grew up in a culture that was not my own culture. So I was a different race, religion, color, everything. And I felt different. And I felt like I never belonged. I felt like I had to work really hard to fit in. And I was completely unaware, everybody around me was unaware that, you know, that it was okay for me to be different. And instead, I spent my entire life feeling there was something wrong with me. But I would want every single child to know that they come with something unique. They're meant to be unique. They're meant to share their uniqueness. I would teach children to embrace their uniqueness and to embrace everybody else's uniqueness. I would also eliminate competition in schools.
Right.
Yeah. Because we compete, and compete comes from fear. It comes from a fear of not being good enough and needing to feel good by being better than the people around us. We don't need that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it doesn't matter. I mean, it's all ego if you're winning a race or your team wins. Yeah. Or it's.
Yeah, and life is not a zero-sum game. You don't have to have losers in order to feel like a winner. You can feel like a winner, and everybody can feel like a winner.
You know, going back to what you said before, I always felt that I was different, not because I looked it or anything. I just always felt outside of the culture somehow, and I always loved that about myself, even though I felt like I never fit in. And that's – I'm still – feel different than everyone else in some ways, you know? And
but see, that's beautiful. That's beautiful to be different. I only embraced the value of being different after my near-death experience. It took that for me to realize, oh, I was meant to be this way. I'm not supposed to try and change it or fit in or make myself small or make myself someone else. And it was only then when I realized, oh, my God, I'm supposed to be this way. This is who I am, and it's amazing, and it's a gift. And that's what kids need to know.
Mm. And so I like what you said about no competition and sports and the ego against one ego against another. But what other radical, don't hold back, what are the real radical things you do in education?
Oh, wow. It's, in fact, it would be even things to do with our health. I would let kids know that they have the resources within them to heal. I think kids need to know that from a young age. And I think what's happening is that a lot of kids are getting the message, for example, that their bodies are unable to heal, so they're becoming more and more sensitive. We are becoming more pathologically fearful about things like illnesses, and we're teaching our kids, don't do that, don't eat that, you know, about hygiene, cleanliness. I think sometimes we go over the top because you look at Western culture, we are getting really, really, you know, we're telling kids, we're drugging up our kids from a very young age for everything. We're giving them shots for everything. Whereas if you go to a third world country, I mean, kids are eating the dirt off the streets and they're still surviving and growing up to be really strong. Our bodies are physically very, very resilient and kids need to know that. And this is why sometimes when we're growing up thinking that everything's going to make us sick. And that's the other thing I would change with kids. You know, I would really like them to know that they are physically much stronger than what kids currently believe they are.
And of course, you probably, or I would like to add this idea that, you know, that magnificent, from that grand place that you came back from, that that's available. But the problem with that is it starts to impact on religious belief. But what you say, yes, in a sense, is that you came from a place beyond religion. So in a sense, you're at odds with the religious dogma because you realized, yes, it was dogma. But how would you teach something like that?
Again, okay, so if we go really radical, now this is radical because most schools do follow the principle of one or the other religion. You know, most schools are probably supported by a particular religion.
Or science that says there is no such thing as, yes, consciousness. So that's another thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And what was really interesting when I was at school, another thing that used to confuse me was that in science we would learn one thing. We would learn Darwinian's theory of evolution, and we would learn about how humans came about. And in religious studies, we were studying the Bible, and we would learn about how we were started from Adam and Eve, how God created Adam and Eve. And it's totally contradictory. And I would get reprimanded for questioning it. And then when I was at home, my parents were teaching me about karma and reincarnation and about the Bhagavad Gita and things like that. And they were praying to the deities in the little home temple we had. So I used to, in school, I used to get reprimanded for questioning that. Now, I would encourage that kind of questioning if it was up to me. I really would. And I would let kids choose what they want to believe. I wouldn't, I don't agree with indoctrinating a child into one religion and making them believe that that is the one and only true faith, because I think that actually creates division amongst people, amongst cultures globally. It doesn't make us united as a, you know, as a race, as a human race. That's, it's actually very divisive.
But you went to a place, in a sense, that's beyond religion. You said God is not a being. God is being.
God is a state of being.
Yes.
Here, yes, what I experienced was that when I was in the other realm, it was like a realm of non-duality. It was like I just merged with what I can only, the only name I can give it is pure consciousness. It was like I became one with everyone and everything. And if you ask me, like say, when I come back and I say, this is what I learned. And if you ask me, who was it that was telling you this? Was it God? You know, it's like, was it God? Was it Jesus? Was it Krishna? It didn't feel like anyone was telling me. It felt like I became this all-knowing state that just knew everything. It was like life completely made sense. It was like I became the knowledge. I became one with all thought, all knowing, all people. I became one with everything that has existed and that is yet to exist. That's what it felt like. It was, and that's what I would call the non-duality state, where there's no separation between me and all knowledge. And I believe this is where we all go. We all merge with it. But when we're here, once we're in the physical body, because bear in mind that in that realm, there's no physical body. There's no biology. There's no body. And without the body, there's no culture. There's no race. There's no religion. There's no gender. So there's none of the dogma or the biases or anything that's attached to all of that. It was just pure consciousness. And here, in this physical realm, it's what I call a state of duality, which means it's a state of separation where I'm expressing through a physical body. This physical body has physical limitations. This realm, this existence has physical limitations. So we call it a state of duality. And I have a race, a gender, a culture, and I exist at a point in physical time and space. In the other realm, there was also no point in physical time and space. It felt like I was everywhere at the same time. But it felt like I could be anywhere at any time I wanted to be.
But even though you have a race and gender here, what you really are, even here in the physical, and what's speaking is consciousness. It's awareness.
Yes.
So how are you? Well, then can't you still be connected to that other realm? Because you know the gender and race is all really an illusion, because who you are is what you've always been.
Exactly. So we are actually always connected. And that is the magnificence that I talk about. We are always connected, but we forget that connection. We forget that we are that. We are that. We are every race, every gender. We are everything, even every tree, every criminal. We are connected with everything. We're connected to Jesus, Allah, Buddha, as well as every criminal in every prison. And we forget that connection when we come here and express through our bodies. And we identify so strongly with our body, our physical body, and our race, and our culture, and our religion, and our gender. And we think that this is it, and we have to defend it. And even when we get glimpses of information that filters through from that grandness, that glorious part of us of which we are all part of, we see that as coming from external. And so we say, that was Jesus talking to me, or Krishna, or Sai Baba. You know, we give it something, but actually all of it is us. It's still us.
Right. So
it's our own consciousness.
Right. So can you talk about you? Because you had that experience. Now you're back. Are you still aware all the time of this magnificence, of this non-dual state of being?
Most of the time, yes. And there are moments dealing with physical reality and physical day-to-day reality. There are moments where you get big jolts and you realize that, okay, this is going to be difficult, and there where you just get kind of knocked out of things. And then I get knocked out of being in that state. But then I just have to accept this is fine. This is part of the physical existence, and it's also a gift. It's part of the experience of being here.
What knocks you out? I'm just curious.
It's quite interesting. I think one of the biggest hits I got, and it's interesting because after a little while I realized it was a huge gift. One of the biggest things that happened to me was when I was originally sharing my story on the internet, and I was just sharing my story freely, and I wasn't actually even using my full name because I wasn't sure how it would be received, but I felt people needed to know it. And I received a huge following just sharing it on the internet. And then I suddenly got attacked by a small group. It's not a huge group of people, but it made an impact on me, a small group of debunkers. And I guess, you know, every internet forum deals with this when you're talking about this kind of thing, but they really went after me in a big way, and it affected me. You know, it was like, what, for the first few months, maybe close to a year, when I was sharing and the feedback I was getting was amazing, and I thought, wow, you know, it's really true. This is what I was supposed to come back and share, and people were sharing the website in where I was sharing my insights. People were emailing it, and it went viral, and it attracted a lot of people. And I thought, wow, this is, it makes me feel so good that it's helping people, and all that suffering I went through. I had cancer for 4 years. So I was communicating with people who had cancer and people who wanted to just know more about the afterlife, people who had lost close friends and relatives, close family members. They wanted to know more. And I just felt it was really great. It was just a service. I was just doing it, you know, because I felt that this is what I was meant to do. But when I got cyber attacked, at first, you know, I mean, I just started explaining myself and going and talking about my near-death experience and telling them, and I was actually dialoguing with them. But I would get drawn in where they would draw me in and I would dialogue with them, and then it would be an attack. They would take me, like, it's hard to explain, but they would take you down to a dead end. Like, at the end, everything I said would end up being, but you can't prove it. It cannot be replicated, and therefore it's not true. It's not real. It's not. And so what turned out to be a really good thing over time, it was like every morning if I logged in to check the responses, these debunkers, what they would say, it would actually color my day. And I found that as I would go through the day, I was losing that feeling of magic, you know, their words would start to play in my head.
So and how so did I would, you turn it around and make it a good thing?
I stopped. I just completely stopped. I stopped posting about it, stopped talking about it. I had to do that for my own peace of mind. And I had to find that space again within me. I had to find and get in touch with it. And it took quite a few months. What I did was I distracted myself. I went off and got on with my regular work because I used to be less focused on my day-to-day work and more focused on, like, constantly writing and posting and blogging and talking to all these people, cyber people.
Can I just ask you, do you need to take a glass of water, a drink?
I'll just take a quick
take your time. It's okay. We have as much time as you. I just felt like you probably needed to have a sip of water.
There, I'm good. Thank you. And so I just cut myself off from that cyber world for a while and just focused. I actually just focused on things that made me feel good. And consciously, every day, I would wake up and ask myself, okay, what will make me feel good today? What brings me joy? And here's something I realized. I realized that if we don't love ourselves enough, I would have continued to get sucked in and felt that it is my duty, even if it drains me, to continue to post and help these people. But I remember that now I love myself unconditionally. It's my duty to take care of me first. And so I pulled away from it. And I hadn't realized how much those people had played on my mind. And it took me longer than I thought because I really had to reconnect and I really had to start communicating again internally, you know, feel like communicating, whether it's communicating with my higher self, my guides, my deceased loved ones. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all one. But I had to get back in touch with that, feel their presence around me, feel the guidance around me. And I had to start feeling it and start seeing the physical life in front of me change to reflect again this new joyful state, which I had actually started to lose.
So,
and once,
No, they were helping you in a sense, the negative feedback was helping you gain more power in yourself, more strength in yourself.
Yes, but not only that, what happened is that once I got back into that state of joy, in that state of power, once I got it all back and I felt that it was back, and I made a decision not to go back to posting on the internet. I thought, okay, I'm going to follow my bliss and see where this takes me. It was like, now let's try something different. I was done with that. And then it was at that point when I was ready, I was open to something new. A friend of mine contacted me and said, I would really like to fly you down to Dubai to speak at my holistic healing center. So I went down to speak at her holistic healing center to share my story. And bear in mind, what I was doing as a day job was completely different. It was, you know, more, I was training people in corporate about culture, as in intercultural training about Chinese culture, Hong Kong culture, which is where I live. So she flew me down to speak about my near-death experience to her clients who she does healings for every day at this holistic healing center. And so there was this room full of people, and I shared my story. And when I saw their reaction and the way they opened up to me and the way they reacted to my story, once again, I was like totally moved. And I thought, even though I'm done with sharing on forums, there's something here. It was like I was just completely moved. They were moved, but I was as moved as they were by how they were feeling. And I thought, maybe I'm supposed to share my story in person to people. And interestingly, the very next day after that was actually my birthday, and I woke up in Dubai and I checked my emails, and there was an email from Hay House saying Wayne Dyer has read my story that's floating around on the internet and has become a fan, and Hay House would like me to write a book and they would like to publish it, and Wayne Dyer would like to write the foreword and they will promote it. So it was incredible how it happened. It was like as soon as I was ready, as soon as I found my joy by finding myself and by being who I am, it opened up. It just came to me.
Well, I just want to add that you are going to be in New York City with Wayne Dyer on November 3rd as part of a Hay House I Can Do It weekend at the Javits Center in New York City, November 3rd. You can look at that on the Hay House special. Actually, I have a advertisement for that on my website, newrealities.com. Is that the first time you'll be meeting Wayne in person?
No. Oh, no. I've been traveling with him for the last year, because this happened, as I said, on my birthday on March 16, 2011. And then after I signed the book deal and I started working on the book with the editor, they actually flew me down to appear on his public television special, which is still currently being aired. So that was the first time I met him. And then I started appearing at the I Can Do It's. I've already appeared on 5 or 6 with him. So it's been just under 1 year, and I've been touring with him to I've been to Pasadena, Australia, London, Scotland. It'll be New York next month.
I'll see you in New York. Sure, I'll be there.
Oh, fabulous. It'll be so nice to meet you.
Yes. And, you know, it seems like the whole near-death phenomenon is really in the news. Did you read the article in Newsweek about the doctor, the neurologist? Yes.
Absolutely. I've even communicated with him. He actually wrote to me when my book got published to tell me that he's had a near-death experience and he's writing a book.
He seems like a great guy. I've seen some interviews with him, and what he says, and you could now tell those debunkers, that there was absolutely no brain activity at all that could have produced some kind of conscious effect within the physical body, of the physical body.
Absolutely. I mean, there was no brain activity. And the thing is, Ibn Alexander is a great guy, and he is really sticking his neck out there to, you know, I mean, somebody in that field to risk everything and share a story and to take all that criticism. I don't think he deserves it. He is really a brave guy. He's a good guy. And, I can't say enough nice things about him, and I think that what he's doing, he's actually doing it for the people. He's doing it because I actually believe that if, you know, the debunkers and the people who just don't listen to any argument, but they're just out there to knock you down, it's not about me, but I feel that they, for their own sake, they're limiting their own experience of what life is all about and what life is meant to be. And I believe that what they're doing is more a reflection of their own fears. And that's what I've come to understand.
Oh, absolutely. It must come from fear, because when you grow up with an opinion, an idea of how the world is, and someone comes along and tells you a different story, you feel threatened. It's the kind of emotional defense they come from.
Yes, it is. Oh, and what I wanted to add was that why I feel now the debunkers were a gift is because when I would write answering their questions, because their questions came from a much more skeptical perspective, ready to debunk anything I said. So when I was dialoguing with them, not always realizing what direction it would go, I noticed that my writing would go into a much deeper, richer, more logical direction to try and make sense of it to them. And a lot of that, which I've written for the debunkers, has been woven into my book. So basically, my book goes into various different directions, and a lot of it is written in very straightforward without any of the fluffy woo-woo. And I think a lot of it was probably inspired because I was dialoguing with debunkers a lot. So I believe that talking to them added a depth and a richness to my book, which I am grateful for.
Well, the thing also about what Dr. Eben Alexander, for people who haven't seen last week's Newsweek magazine cover article, Heaven is Real, A Doctor's Experience with the Afterlife, is with a neurosurgeon who was an atheist, who was in a coma, who had a beautiful journey into these other realms. And it's very similar to what you describe in your book, his
experience. Yes.
So that sort of proves, if you can use that word, prove that that's a space that exists.
Yes. And not only that, you know, the thing about a lot of the debunkers, and I use the word debunkers deliberately and not skeptics, because there's nothing wrong in being a healthy skeptic. I've got nothing against skeptics, because I believe skeptics are people who just don't get convinced by anything that easily, but they can be open to looking at every argument, and eventually many skeptics turn into believers. Debunkers is a completely different kettle of fish, where they really are closed, and they're there. It's almost like a game to them to knock everything. But they start out leading you to believe that, oh, there's nothing wrong with me being a healthy skeptic. But only when you get drawn into the dialogue with them do you realize they're actually debunkers. And what I want to say is that what happens is that they will work with one story at a time and debunk that one story and find the flaws in that. What they will never do is they will never look at the collective, like how many stories, how many people are having these experiences. And when you put them all together, how can you explain the whole phenomena? How can you just wipe it out like that? So with each story, they will pick at one flaw or one thing, and they can only do it. They can only debunk when they're talking about one story at a time. Mm-hmm. But when you go to them with the whole collection of stories, then it's much harder, and they don't get into that kind of discussion. One of the things that nobody has yet been able to explain is how I was able to hear conversations that were happening, like all the way, like down a hallway, because I felt as though I was everywhere at the same time. I could hear conversations taking place between my husband and the doctor, which they later said took place 40 feet down the hallway. And I didn't realize that they were that far away. I was able to tell the doctor exactly what he did when I was in the coma, how he removed fluid from my lungs by inserting a needle through my back. And he was really surprised. He said, "But how do you know that? You were in a coma." I even told him what time it was when he did that.
I think we can do that, those kind of things now as well within this realm. We have to practice that.
Yes, I totally, you see, that's the thing. I believe that once we realize that we can do it and it can be done, we will start to do it more and more. But it'll only start to happen when we bring it into our awareness that, hey, how do I make it happen in this realm? Let's do it. And we talk about it. And so we bring it into our awareness, and then it becomes a possibility, not just a possibility, but it becomes something that we do easily.
Right. I've done it. I've done remote viewing. I've had out-of-body experience. I mean, I know it's possible. So, I mean, the importance of what you're doing and Dr. Eben Alexander, who wrote the article about Heaven is Real, is that we're expanding what's possible for the human being.
Yes.
And that's what this new time is about. So I think Alexander is doing it for the same reason you're doing it. In a way, it's his mission. He's compelled to do it, not by himself. I mean,
I know, and I think it's fantastic because he's paving the way for the rest of us. I think if I get a debunker, I'll send them Eben's way.
Right. And what's the amazing thing about him is he was a total atheist. He was just a very academic, when you're dead, you're dead. If there's no brain activity, there can't be any consciousness. So,
absolutely. And not only that, he is a neuroscientist. He is he's a scientist, very well respected in his industry. So I think it couldn't have happened to a more appropriate person.
So don't you think there's a conspiracy on the part of existence, in a sense, that your book is a bestseller and this guy's had this experience on the cover of Newsweek?
And his is definitely a bestseller as well. So.
Oh, he's already getting, yes.
No, I'm sure he will be. If he isn't already, I'm sure he will be.
No, he is already. I think he's overwhelmed with what's coming to him in a good way. So I think, though, we're ready for this shift in a global awareness.
I think so. And I think probably what's happening is that, you know, whatever it is that's driving us, I don't like to give it a name or a label, because we all have our different interpretations, whether we want to call it the consciousness or our guides or whatever, or the higher part of our own self. I think it's probably feeling, well, okay, enough is enough. It's time to inundate the planet with this.
Right. Have some people connect that to like the whole end of the Mayan calendar 2012 time, which I think is really just us increasing our vibration and becoming open to new possibilities.
Yes, I think it's just that. Yeah, it's just the way evolution is going. I mean, we tend to think, usually people tend to think of evolution just in terms of physical evolution, and that's what we learn in school. But I think there's more to evolution than that. You know, and it could be anything. There could be races that are way well advanced than us that are living simultaneously to us right now.
Mm-hmm. I think so. But I just want to ask you a little more about the whole process, because in that near-death experience, it's not like going to sleep, which has been the great kind of analogy in poetry, but like, you know, when you're sleeping, you don't really remember. You're sort of aware, but then you wake up. But it's a different state of consciousness. Can you, like, talk about that moment of going from, like, the consciousness of being here and how it wasn't actually a sleepless?
No, it's the total opposite. It feels like I woke up. That consciousness makes this realm feels like we're sleeping in this realm. And a lot of people say to me that, how do you differentiate it from dreaming? You know, it's like when you wake up in this realm, and sometimes when you've had a dream, could it have just not been a dream state? And no, there's a huge difference. When I was in that state, it felt like I had woken up, and this state feels like the dream state. And that's a distinct difference. It was like I have never felt more awake, more alert, and everything felt so clear and so sharp. And it was like everything made sense. Everything just made sense. The world made sense. And it felt as though all of time, all of space existed simultaneously, and yet it felt it made sense for it all to exist simultaneously. Here, trying to understand it with the physical mind, it actually sounds more confusing and complicated. And here we feel it's simpler to see time and space as something that only exists one point of time at a time and only one being in one place in space at a time. And so it's very, very linear. We can only be in one place at a time and we can only experience one point of time at a time. And that lends an air of clarity to physical being. But in the other realm, it felt that this felt very limiting, and just being aware, I guess I use the example of a tapestry. If you look at a tapestry, a huge tapestry with all the threads of the different colors woven through, you can see the entire tapestry. And imagine if you are one thread in the tapestry. So if I am one thread from that realm, I could see every life that I had already touched with my life, everything that I had already done, but also every life that I was yet to touch and everything I was yet to do as a completed picture, and everybody else's. So if the tapestry was all of time and all of space made the complete picture, seeing it all at once made the complete picture, that's what it felt like. It was like, oh, it makes sense. That's why this happened. That's why that happened, for this to happen. And that's why I did that, so that that could happen.
Was there any – yeah, no, thank you for that. That's and it still makes sense that that is all unfolding, this conversation. Everything is just part of a huge tapestry. Everyone everywhere is contributing to that beautiful picture, design, that dynamic change in this flowing of being, I guess is a way of saying it. But did you have a sense of any type of body? I mean, I know it wasn't a physical body, but a sense of a container, a vehicle, of consciousness or something?
There wasn't a limitation to my because having a body puts a restriction or a limitation. So I use the word awareness. That's the closest word I can think of, because all it felt, even though I was aware of my self, there was no limit to who the self was. It was like I was limitless and everywhere at the same time. And so there wasn't like a container or a limitation to how much room or space I encompassed or that I took up. There wasn't a limit to it.
Mm. But do we ever totally, are we always that? So you had a sense of yourself and your history and everyone you've been, but are we ever completely absorbed? I don't know. I mean, maybe you don't know. Into the oneness of, yeah.
I understand what you're saying, and there is a possibility, because I did reach a point where, you know, on the one hand, I felt like I had access, I became one with everything, but yet I was aware that I was one with the essence of my father, the essence of my best friend, the essence of other deceased people who I felt were there, who were there guiding. And even though we became one, it was like my essence merged with them. I was aware they were there. So, although I did reach a point where I understood that I couldn't go any further than that. If I went further, I wouldn't be able to turn back. But at the same time, being merged with everyone made me look at things like, you know, when we think we were somebody in a past life, mm-hmm. It made me realize that we don't necessarily have to have been that person in a past life. We are those people right now. We are merged with them when we're not in our bodies. Mm. We are those people, and they bleed through us when we allow it to. Mm. And lives don't happen sequentially, because time is not linear. It's not like I was somebody in a past life and I'll be someone in another life. It's all simultaneously. When we, it's like the tapestry. You're looking at all the lives simultaneously.
It's all simultaneous, but this moment now that exists for us in this life.
This is where our awareness is right now.
Yeah, well, what is that? I mean, what I'm just questioning, I don't know if you have an answer, but that, what we call that awareness of what we have right now, that we're not in the moment we just were because we're in this moment now. But what is that thing that is awareness of this that is now in this moment?
This current specific moment where we're aware right now, this, I guess this is just, our physical expression can only be aware in one present moment at a time. And that's what we're feeling. It's like, it's the concentration of our awareness just being expressed in one moment. And in terms of the simultaneous, I liken that to almost being like, if you imagine an apartment building with an elevator, all the floors exist simultaneously, but you can choose to get off on the second floor or the fourth floor or the third floor. So you who travels up and down the elevator, you are awareness, and all the different floors is the simultaneous lives. Mm-hmm. And so you can choose which floor to be on. But if you're on the third floor, it doesn't mean that the fourth floor or the fifth floor don't exist. They all exist simultaneously. But your awareness at this precise moment in time happens to be in the fourth floor.
Right. No, I get that. I get, and that's very clear. You know, I talked to Mellon Thomas. You know who he is? Mellon Thomas Benedict?
Yes. Yes.
When he had this near death or died, he met the light, and there was this light presence that showed him everything. And he also says that he goes back to that light all the time. He doesn't have to die. He's just in touch with that. But it sounds different than what you had. And I know everyone has their own sort of, you know, take on it. But is it different than what you had, or is he just expressing it different?
I think we all express it differently, because I think even when he talks about going back to the light, I think that it's exactly the same as what I need to do to recharge my batteries. Like, especially when I said that I felt really, really low, because of the debunkers, I had to get back in connection. And I think because of our culture, our language, our way of interpreting things, we use different words in different ways. But basically, I think what I did was pretty similar to what you've described he does there, was to reconnect with my own light. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Take a glass of water.
Thank you. And so that's what I actually did, was to reconnect. And when I felt that connection again, and I felt one with it again, and I felt the guidance flowing from within, or from my own inner self, higher self, whatever we want to call it, or my guides. When I felt that flowing again, that was when I was connected again. And I think we just have different ways. And I think the reason why it's open to so much misinterpretation is because there are no words in the English language to describe something that's so ineffable. It's, you know, we are so used to describing things we label everything, so we need everything to have physical form and limitation. Even when we talk about our spirit, our soul, we give it a shape, an outline, but there isn't. There's no shape. There's no outline. It's just pure essence.
Right. I do know what you mean. I do have a sense of that. When I had an out-of-body experience, people say there's a silver cord or something. There was nothing like that, but there was the awareness of the connection to the body. And I think that's what people metaphorically say is like a cord, but it's an awareness.
Yes, exactly. And I'm so glad that you've had out-of-body experiences, because you know exactly how it feels, and yeah, you would understand. And I think we really need to develop a language for it. Mm-hmm. Either that, or we would start needing to learn to speak some of the old languages like Sanskrit or something.
But yeah, and I think both are happening. I think we are developing a culture because of the things that are coming into mainstream, because the debunkers, you know, they're sort of, they're fighting a losing battle in the sense that the culture is changing, and we are developing new words and new ideas and new means of communication that really express these ideas. You know, they say science changes one funeral at a time, meaning that the old guard can't hold on to the expanding ideas that the new is
yes.
through. So it is changing.
Yes, it absolutely is changing. I mean, you know, it's changing slowly. And I think, though, one of the big problems right now is that a lot of people are becoming disillusioned with religion because with all the different religions, there's a lot of strife and people fighting, you know, because there's so many religious wars and we know it. We don't, we can't deny it that most of the wars are, they're based on, they're instigated by different religions or that's what influences them. And I think when people become disillusioned with religion, they then turn to science or they start to debunk everything or they say that, oh, I'm an atheist. But what you will actually find is that many people are actually looking for they're still looking for something. They've just become disillusioned with orthodox religion. Mm-hmm. But so many of them are still actually looking for something more, because they've had experiences that they can't deny. They've had experiences of, you know, whether it's out-of-body experiences or certain ESP type of experiences or supernatural experiences, or they've seen visions or ghosts or things like that. They've had experiences, but they can't seem to make it fit into the religion that they grew up.
Or the science they grew up either, you know.
Exactly. They can't make it fit either, yeah, the science or the religion. So people are looking for something. And I think that this is why we've got to stop being so rigid and boxing things. We've got to stop being so dogmatic about both science and religion, because both can be equally dogmatic and fundamentalistic.
Well, we need to expand what, you know, Edgar Mitchell called it a noetic science, a science based on consciousness. And, you know, if what happened to you happened to this guy, Dr. Eben Alexander, that happened to Mellon Thomas and probably
yes,
thousands of people, I mean, throughout history, if this place really exists, then there's a science of this level. Well, not quite provable, but it's an existence that is, in a sense, a fact, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and I think that if, say, for example, the skeptics, the debunkers, and the hardcore scientists, if people stopped being really dogmatic about it and looked at it as a whole, we could really start to maybe conduct a different type of experiment, because I feel that when the experiments they conduct actually disprove it, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means they're conducting the wrong types of experiments.
Exactly. They can only conduct an experiment based on the level that they're at, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like in any actually scientific test, you can only prove what you know, what you think is there.
Yeah.
But if they did do what you're saying, these other types of experiments, I think they would actually prove that there's maybe we don't have to call it a religion, but a spirituality that has a higher science to it, that they're one in the same on this other level.
Yeah, exactly. We have to even either call it something else or don't give it a name or something, but there has to be a new paradigm, if you will, which has to be held in as high an esteem as science is held today. But, you know, it has to be allowed to look at in an objective way things that cannot be proven by science, that don't fit into religious dogma, but yet does exist out there.
Well, it has to. I mean, what you're saying is, and it happened with you, and, you know, no one's going to tell you your experience isn't true, because you know, there's no way of arguing with experience or these people, then we have to look at a different set of beliefs about what's possible and what consciousness is. Yeah.
Exactly. Because I've had people say to me that, oh, it was the drugs, you know, the drugs do that to you. They make you hallucinate. And I say, that's fine. Okay. It was the drugs, but what you cannot deny, which I have medical proof for, is that my cancer just completely turned around when it happened. It just completely turned around. And the doctors had given me up for dead, and my family was waiting for me to take my last breath. But within 4 days of this experience, my tumors shrunk, and I had tumors from the base of my skull all the way down around my neck, my chest, my underarms, and all the way down to my abdomen. They all shrunk by 70% in 4 days.
Wow.
Within a month, they couldn't find any trace of cancer in my body. So if you're not willing to look at what caused it to turn around, then aren't we denying a lot of people the possibility of healing from diseases? Like, I'm not saying I know the answer. I'm not saying, you know, because I've had people even say to me, so you had this experience. How does it help other people who have cancer? You don't have the answer on how it can be replicated. I haven't come back to say I have the cure for cancer, but I'm saying it happened to me. And if we're actually willing to change up some of our scientific experiments to take different things into consideration and to open up to things, maybe a different type of experiment can be conducted rather than just constantly developing more and more drugs and diagnostic tools.
Mm-hmm.
How about we look at something different? That's basically all I'm trying. Yeah. What I want people in the scientific field to know.
No, but to add, I mean, thank you. I totally appreciate what you just said, but also adding to that is this realization that you had in that other world about the magnificence and the love. And you came back in a sense infused with, a joy and a passion, and it was that change in consciousness that obviously, and this is probably can be proven, changes the chemicals in the body to function differently because your state of awareness and attitude was different. So your whole physiology was in a sense different than what it was.
It's absolutely different, and it is purely just, for me, it was purely just knowing. It's like this inner knowing that I am part of something greater and huger. And it just made me feel so secure and loved, and just this feeling that I just have to be me. And I came here with a purpose and a message. And I just feel that made such a huge difference. And it makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference in my life every day. And it feels like, even, you know, when people say that, oh, thank you for sharing your story, it really made a difference in my life and it touched me, I still get so surprised when people say that, because I feel I haven't done anything. I'm just being myself. And that's all I need to do. And that's all we all really need to do. It's just such an incredible feeling. And I feel that if we get in touch with that, if we can just know that, if we can just know that, we will eliminate not only illness, but a lot of the other problems and strife on this planet.
I agree, but I think that's the new science. I mean, the new science. You had an experience. In your book, you say you let go of everything completely, wanting to be healed or not healed, beliefs. You totally let go. That allowed existence to fill you up with what it was and yourself, and you realized who you were. But how do we actually do that? I mean, everyone wants to know, because that is the healing in a sense.
Yes. Yes, that is the healing. What I would suggest for people to do is that I would start with, like, maybe every evening or every morning and evening, is really when you go to bed and even when you wake up in the morning, is to actually let go of everything, like at night before going to bed. Let go of everything that has happened during the day. It really is letting go of every feeling, every fear, getting in touch with all the, being aware, sorry, not getting in touch, being aware of every tension in your body, in your physical body, and in your mind and in your heart and all over you, because it collects in your muscles and it creates tension. But it means every, every wrong word you heard that day, every taxi driver that got annoyed at you or something, just letting it go and realizing that everybody is on their own journey, and whatever they've done, even if somebody's hurt you, they've done it from their own pain. So, and you know, some people have suggested that, is it forgiveness? Is it that every night you forgive everyone? I say, no, it's something beyond forgiveness. Because when you forgive somebody, you're saying, you hurt me, you were wrong, but I'm going to forgive you for being wrong, or forgive you for what you've done. This is something different. It's not even judging that the person was even wrong. You can only forgive someone when you feel that what they've done was wrong. But when you don't even feel they were wrong, what you feel is compassion. You feel that what they did out of their own fear and out of their own pain. And so you only feel compassion for where they are right now. That person must have had a crappy day or going through a lousy marriage or whatever it is. And then when you realize that there's a lot of people carrying a lot of pain, all you feel for them is compassion. And it's getting to that place, and it really is a case of reminding yourself every day. The other exercise I actually tell people to do, which I find very, many people have found very, very helpful, is that every single day, write down 5 things about yourself that you really love and appreciate about yourself, because it helps to be empathetic towards other people when you love yourself unconditionally. And most of us, if I was to tell people, write things that you don't like about yourself, or things you want to change, or, you know, things about yourself that annoy you, they come out with a list as long as their arm. And when I say write things you like about yourself, they're like stumped. They'll come out with 2, 3. So I say, force yourself to do this. You're going to do this every day. Whatever it is, whether it's the way you like, the way you handled something, or certain talents you have, recognize them. And really, really recognize them and become aware of them. And find 5 different things every day, whether it's how blessed you are to have wonderful friends, and you must be somebody special to have such great friends, whatever it is, you know, and
find what's special about yourself.
Exactly. Find what's special about yourself and force yourself to write 5 different things every single day. And if we can do that, and at the same time, if we can release everything that we're holding, all the pain, all the hurt, all the judgment we feel towards others, if we can start to consciously let go, even if you have to do it with a guided meditation, or you have to do it through music, or even if you prefer to do it sitting on a beach listening to the waves, whatever it is, consciously start to release. And then tell yourself, I trust in the guidance that's going to come through me. Every morning I remind myself that every day is really special, and I trust everything that's going to happen today is happening for my own good. It's for my own purpose. It's the tapestry. It's the tapestry unveiling itself. It's my thread weaving its way through this tapestry to complete it in the best way possible. And I just remind myself of that every single morning.
It's also forgiving yourself. I mean, yes, forgiving others. And you talked about how it you can feel that tension building up in your body. And in a sense, you sort of seem like you say that that's in a sense what killed you is that,
yes,
that self-judgment and that building up and not forgiving yourself. So I think that's probably
that.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly right. And I'll tell you something that also I found was something that really changed for me since the near-death experience. Prior to that, if somebody criticized me, I'd be really defensive and I would think I would notch that up as something wrong with me that I had to change. If someone said, oh God, you know, you're such a whatever, you're such a people pleaser or you're whatever it is. And oh, you're being fickle. You've switched from one belief to another or something like that. And I would say, no, I'm not. And I would justify it. If someone said that to me today, I would actually laugh and I'll say, oh yeah, you're right. I am. That's me. This is what I believe right now. I might believe something different tomorrow. And it's very liberating to feel I don't have to justify who I am. It's okay. It doesn't matter what people say about me. It's okay.
Right. Some I think Shirley MacLaine said, what people think about me is none of my business.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't have to justify it. So it is about forgiving yourself and allowing yourself to be who you are. And I've found that to be really liberating that, you know, I don't have to bend over backwards to, you know, I don't have to be called to attention or you don't own me because you criticize me. I don't have to do anything about it.
And I think it's also about loving the body. The body is like this child that wants nurturing and love also. And would you put something poison in to give it to a child? No, you want to nourish it. I mean, that's how
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing I tell people. Treat yourself like you would your own child. Yeah. Or even your own pet. You know, we love our pets, our dogs, our cats. We love our children. And we treat them really well, but we don't treat ourselves that well.
Right. And if we did, but you said when you had these experiences with the debunkers that you went inside and kind of re-found that. What did you do? What did you do what you just said? Or were there other things that you did that where you went in and reestablished that connection?
What I did was I actually consciously accessed that space I was in when I was in my near-death experience. I went back to that space. And in order to do that, I had to actually spend a lot of time alone. And I spent time in nature. And I just had to sit still with absolutely no outside input and try to recreate that space of. And when I was in nature, for me, it's being on the beach and listening to the waves. I was able to connect again to that expanse, you know, that feeling of being connected to everyone and everything. And then I found my connection even with the debunkers. Mm. And I no longer felt that they were attacking me. I felt that they were expressing where they were in their lives right now. And I was completely able to feel compassion for them. And I felt, it was like I felt their fear and it made me gain deeper understanding of just not, you know, and I didn't have to be with them physically, but just being connected to the everything, the all that is, it made me gain deeper understanding of why they did what they did or do what they do.
Right. Do you think you ever want to just be in nature all the time? I mean, I know you have a mission and you're doing it. I mean, I love the fact that you're so available, but just stay in nature. Would you want to just kind of live in that place all the time? Because, you know,
I think I need the oscillation between the two. Now, I moved home about a few years ago to a place that's right by the sea and in nature. And I need to be here to recharge my batteries. I really need to be here. And so what I like is the fact that because of technology, I can make myself available. And of course, you know, flying to places. But when I come here, I also have the choice of just closing myself off and recharging my batteries. And I actually love the contrast. I love the contrast of being out there on tour, on a I Can Do It trip with Wayne Dyer and speaking in front of an audience of thousands of people. I love that. That really buzzes me. And then I love coming back home to my quiet home right by the sea and just cutting myself off. I love the contrast and oscillating between the two. It seems to work for me perfectly right now. And I'm writing a second book right now as well.
Oh, you are? About sort of the next step of your journey, or is it something different?
It's actually going a little bit deeper into a lot of the things that we just talked about, deeper into things like how to connect with this other state, how to actually be in connection or have that connection. It's also more of a realization for everybody, how to make it more accessible to everyone, this feeling of oneness, and everything to even talking about illnesses and about deeper conversation about religion. And so basically it's my own thoughts and feelings, but it's my own understanding after the experience, the understanding I've gained and a lot of it has been inspired by questions that I have received from people since the first book came out. And so all the questions that people ask me, all the interviews I've done, you know, like this one where I answer questions that are, and my answers, what I speak about is not in the book. So the second book will cover all these deeper concepts.
That's exciting. When will that be out, or when do you think it could be finished?
It'll be out next year. I'm hoping to finish it. I have to submit it by March of 2013 for it to be out by October of next year, of 2013. So that's what I'm hoping. So it's still a year away, but yeah, it's so right now all these dialogues and everything, all of it just enriches the next book.
Well, I have a question for the next book.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, in a sense, you've seen all of time and all of space from that point beyond death, and yet you're living it out moment to moment. But that's one part. And then I also want to know, how is consciousness evolving? I mean, it seems like things individually and collectively are moving, in a sense, in new directions. So
yes, it is moving. But you know, here's the dichotomy. This is sometimes so hard to explain. On the one hand, we cannot help but evolve, just like we are evolving physically. You know, we evolved from the ape and so on. So we're evolving physically. So consciousness in its own way is evolving, and people will evolve. But we, our only responsibility is to evolve our own self. We are not meant to. We can talk about it the way we are. We can bring awareness to other people. But if we go out and try to change the world, we are bringing the same fear energy that we are actually trying to change. Because what we are doing, when you go out and change the world and you say, we need to do this, we need to do this, what happens is that we end up only judging, you know, and we're all guilty of it. It's like, I don't plan to go out and actually change the education system or fight the status quo, because fighting comes from fear. And what happens is when I go and fight, it would make other people defensive. Mm-hmm. But all I can share is my view, my vision, what I experienced in the other realm, what I feel that children need to know. But it's up to other. So when more and more people hear of it, it's up to them to take it on board. And if they think, oh my, that resonates with me, that sounds good, and they take it on board, then it starts to change. So our responsibility, mine, yours, Eben Alexander's, is to talk about it, to share it, but not go out and fight, because fighting, again, is that same fear energy that comes from, you are wrong and I need to change you. Mm-hmm. And I'm judging you, because all that does is it then creates that antagonism where people become defensive and fight back. And that's what we already have.
Right. So we can't go out and change anybody. I mean, that's just, we have to show by example within ourselves. And like, I love, that's what's great about your book. You didn't write it to change anybody. You just told your story. But in the process, I think people are changed because they connect with the truth of what you say. That's the truth for them.
My only intention is always, has always been and will always be, just to share my own story. And that's what my second book, it's just going to be sharing my own deeper insights and dialogues that I've had with people, and just let people read it. And I feel that when we do that, that's how we touch people on a heart level. They open up instead of dealing on a mind level or a cerebral level or an ego level. It's when we don't feel defensive and when we're just listening. Okay, this is your story. Oh, wow, you said that. That touched me. And that's all we really need to do. So this is the thing, the dichotomy with the evolution. It's not about going out and changing the world. It's about feeling it within yourself and sharing it.
That's beautiful. Maybe we should wrap it up. So, I mean, I could talk for a long time, but, there's also so much love in your book. In the early chapters, the love of your family, of your childhood, of your housekeeper, nurse, and then your husband, of course. He's a beautiful guy.
he's actually the real hero of the book and of my healing. I mean, I just love him to bits.
Is he traveling with you to New York?
Yes, he is. He's amazing. He comes with me everywhere. We just have to do this together.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. And good luck with that second book. And you're going to be talking, you're giving the keynote in New York on November 3rd, right?
With the amazing Wayne Dyer, absolutely. He has been so integral and so key in this, in bringing my story to a broader audience. And I cannot thank him enough for that. But yes, I'll be his guest speaker at the keynote.
Okay.
On November 3rd on Saturday.
At the Javits Center in New York City. You can go to the I Can Do It website. You can see it on my New Reality site. What's your website, Anita?
My website is anitamorjani.com. Anita. And that's, anitamorjani.com.
Uh-huh. Okay, and then are you doing any other engagements after that New York experience?
Yes, in fact I am, and I'd love to tell people about this one as well. I'll be speaking in Monterey on November 9th. That's Monterey, California, on November 9th at the Hyatt Regency, and it's a non-profit event. All profits made from that will go to a hospice foundation. So I'd love to meet people in that area. I'll be signing books, and I'll be doing – in that one, I'll be doing a two-hour speaking presentation, and I will be talking about a lot of the in-depth things like what we talked about today, and we'll be taking questions from the audience. I'd love to meet people.
What's the organization that's doing that?
It's a private person. It's a lady who has invited me to speak, and she's – organized it, and the information is on my website at anitamorjani.com under the events tab, and also on my Facebook page. If you go to my Facebook page, which is just Anita Morjani, you will find the information there as well.
Okay. Oh, that just reminded me of one last question that was kept coming up in the sense that, people are keep on dying, obviously. I mean, it seems like it's happening, but is it possible, I don't know, it's kind of idealistic, for everyone to have what happened to you, the realization of their magnificence and to come back and not have to die in that way?
I I think that that we probably have a time when it is time for us to go, and for some of us it might be sooner, some of us it might be later, because one of the things I strongly sensed was that it felt as though my father was telling me, it's not your time, but you still have the choice of whether you want to go, you know, to stay in that realm or to come back into the physical body. So I actually believe that for some people, it is their time, and they cross over. I think for those that get a choice, one thing I will say is that that state is absolutely amazing. It's like a beautiful, incredible state. And I feel that the ones that, for whom it is their time, who cross over, they're the blessed ones. They're the lucky ones. It's a lot of people feel that I was lucky to get the choice and lucky to get a second chance at life. I want people to look at death differently. That's not necessarily the case. But I may not be the lucky one.
Well, but I do think we have forever to be here, and I think we only have, you know, to be there.
Yes.
So we have to really make the most of what we have here, and I think we are lucky to be here, though, I do have to say.
We are lucky. Being here is a gift. We have forever to be there, and there is amazing, but we get this gift to be here. It feels like such a gift to be here that previous to my near-death experience, I used to focus my life on creating the perfect afterlife. I don't do that anymore. I focus my life every moment on creating the perfect moment, which means creating the perfect life.
Yes.
My life means so much more to me because we have this chance to be here and to be in the physical and to enjoy the gifts that it offers. But I want people to know that their loved ones who are on the other side are not suffering. They are free. They are watching over you. And they are truly in a place of love, absolute, divine, unconditional love. And if any of them chose not to come back, it was not because they didn't love you enough or love their family enough. It was probably because they loved you unconditionally, and that was the better choice for everybody.
Beautiful. I do think we're coming to a new place where we're merging this divine awareness with human existence. And that's what I think is exciting about this next step of evolution. That's what I'm hoping for anyway.
Yes, that's what I feel.
Well, thank you so much, Anita, for your beautiful book. So simple and lovingly written.
Thank you. Oh, and thank you so much for having me on your show. It was such a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld. I've been talking to Anita Moorjani. If you haven't read her book, please. I think it's a kind of classic in the sense that it lays out the whole spiritual terrain, who we really are, and what we've come here to do, all of us, is to enjoy our magnificence. That's Moorjani, or Moorjani, do you say? Moorjani?
Moorjani, yeah.
Moorjani, Dying to Be Me, My Journey from Cancer to Near Death to True Healing, forward by Wayne Dyer, and we'll be seeing her in New York at the I Can Do It Festival. Thanks again, and I will meet you. I'll say hello, okay?
I would love that. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Maybe we'll do a little video interview there sometime if you have a little chance just to do something on camera.
Sure, that would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And your website again is Anita Moorjani.
Yes, that's it.
Okay. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. And I still feel that joy running through me after having finished your book. It is a joy. It's wow. I do feel that magnificence, and everyone does, and it's a kind of sensation in the body.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so happy. Thank you.
Okay, and this program will be posted on bbsradio.com in the archives under New Realities, also on my website, newrealities.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. Good night.